Journey Church is a community and movement, a fellowship of discovery. We desire to love well and serve often, while together we explore the adventurous love story of Jesus.
Hey, good morning. I'm Susie. I'm one of the pastors here at Journey, and I'm really excited to be here with you on this day. So we are in this really cool place in the life of the Journey Church where we've kind of been through a lot and experienced a lot of really, really, really great things in our story as a church. And we're at this place where God is shifting things and moving us into this new chapter. And we're calling, we're not really calling it anything, but we have these whole, my part in the story is like the theme of it, where everybody has a part to play in that, whether it's through your story and through your serving, and just what makes Journey awesome are the people that are here and the collection of stories that are here. So we've been showing you these great videos every week for the last, I think, 3 weeks, kind of showing some people that have been a part of this church for a while and the things that God has been doing in them, but we show them to you with this like really great anticipation that he's not even close to being done with us, and there's some really great things to come. So today we're going to hear from Paula. So turn your attention over to the screen.
My daughter Margaret, freshman year, was asked to come to the youth group at Journey. We went to a different church that we had grown up in. And you're not going to cut off any avenue where your child is hearing, you know, Jesus. So, of course, she said yes. And I would drop her off because she was 14 or 15. And I dropped her off. And then I would pick her up when it was over. Or she would catch a ride with Allsworth, who were our neighbors. And then she asked me to go on Sunday. And I thought, well, first of all, sure, but you need a ride, so I'm going to go with you, because for all I knew, y'all were, you know, Kool-Aid drinking, what, crazy people. So I went, and then I thought, well, she'll never last an hour or 15 minutes. You know, her bottom is used to Presbyterian, and in 48 minutes, you just know it's time to go. And so I was not concerned. So we sat on the front row, and I mean, from the minute we got there, we did not move. And it was over, and it was just like, oh my gosh, and it had been like an hour and 10 minutes, and we wanted more. I have always struggled with anxiety and worry since a young child. It paralyzed me at some point. And I remember it was one of the first sermons, truly, that you said, as believers, all we need to do is love well. And I thought, I was at a point where I was going back into the workforce, you know, looking at 50. And so I thought, well, okay, I can do that. I can love well. I can love. That I can do. And it was just such a baby step to come to full circle at just this complete peace that I've never known. And you talk about rediscovering the sense of wonder.
Yes.
I've done more new things in the last probably 18 months than I have since I can remember,
Honestly.
Awesome, right? Let's give Paula a hand. So, if you were here a couple weeks ago, we heard Donna Hawkins, and she came to this church with this preconceived notion that we were the young and trendy church. So we've got young and trendy and Kool-Aid drinking crazy people. So if you are new here today, we want to welcome you, because it's awesome here, and you're probably going to fit in somewhere in that space. And if you're home from college, welcome home. Yay. Yeah. And if you're a parent who put a kid through a year of college, good job. So we have a lot to celebrate today. So we're in this series. It's going to last all summer long, and it's on the sound of glory and how to hear from God. And these first few weeks, we're talking about how to hear from God through prayer. And we've heard about all these different elements of prayer. Jamie started us off with silence and solitude, and then rest and imagination. And then Kevin took us to fasting yesterday, or last week. And today we get to talk about intercession, how we hear from God when we intercede on behalf of other people. Now, before we get too far into it, I just want to say that our intention in giving these, putting these practices before you is not to give you a whole nother list of things you need to do. It's never our intention for you to ever walk out of this room feeling like you have to try harder or do more things. Rather, our intention is to help you develop new rhythms in your life that are going to help you hear from God more consistently and less sporadically. So if you're like me and you think you have to do all the things all of the time, you might wake up and think, oh, I got to have this like cool Zen moment of silence, and then I've got to mix in some rest somewhere along the line, and I should probably fast once a week and like do all the things. And that's just not really how it works. They are, first of all, practices, not elements of perfection. They are practices that over time, the more you do them, the more you'll understand the way God has wired you to engage with Him. And they are designed to help you draw near to Him as you need each different one at the time that you need it. They're designed to help you enter in with Him. So I hope that's helpful to you. So Jamie and Angie are living it up in Jamaica this week. And you know, it's Mother's Day, and we're at this intercession point in the whole series, and he wants it to be taught through the story of Esther, who happens to be a Persian queen, so he looks around the staff, and he finds the Persian girl pastor to come and give you the message. So I'm feeling a little bit typecast for this role, but not offended in any way. And as I was walking out the door, my husband told me that I looked very Persian because I had a lot of gold on. So I'm like really trying to like enter into the story with you, and hopefully you'll appreciate it. So we're gonna just kind of go through the whole book of Esther. It's 10 chapters, so if you're hungry, I'm sorry. But we're gonna kind of give like a big overview of the whole story, and then we're gonna come into the middle of it and talk about intercession and what that really looks like through this story. And so before I get into it, I just want to point out two things to you. The first thing that's really curious about this book is that God is never mentioned one time, which is interesting because, you know, the Bible is a book about God, and this book in the Bible never mentions His name one time. But what's so cool is that the author invites us in the story to look for God's activity in the pages of the story, even though his name isn't mentioned. And it's this whole idea that even when God is most hidden, He's still working on behalf of His people. So if you're sitting in this room, particularly today, if you're a mom and your heart is heavy, or you're not a mom and your heart is heavy, and you've been praying these prayers for your children that you have or the children that you don't have yet that you desire, there's this inner groaning sometimes in the heart of a mom. And I want you to know that God sees you and He hears you. And even when He's most hidden and you think, maybe He's not hearing me, maybe He's not seeing me, He does. And it's all evidenced in this amazing story we're gonna hear about today. And it really is a great story. It has all the elements of a great story. It's got a beautiful queen who's the heroine of the story. She goes from being an orphan to a queen, and it's got this crazy kind of king and this little bit of a love story, and then all this like tension and plot twists and violence for those of you who like violence in stories. And then it also has a very redemptive happy ending. But it starts about 100 years after the Babylonian exile. Last week when we heard about Nehemiah, we know that some of the people from the exile went back to Jerusalem. Well, in the story of Esther, we see that some of them didn't, that there's a community of Jewish people that settled in the capital city of the Persian Empire called Susa, and that's where our story starts. And it begins with this King Xerxes, who has thrown for himself two elaborate banquets for the purpose of, it says, to show the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days. So basically, he throws these big parties for 187 days to flex how awesome he is. And on the seventh day, it says, the very last day of the feast, on the 187th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, aka he was drunk, he commanded that his wife, Queen Vashti, be brought to him wearing her royal crown so that everyone could gaze upon her beauty because she was lovely to look at. Now, some commentators will actually say that he wanted her to come only wearing her crown. And Queen Vashti, being a very progressive woman at the time, was like, no, I am not your trophy wife, and I'm not doing that. And so the king became enraged in his merry, filled-with-wine heart. And at the same time, all the dudes he was partying with became enraged because they're like, well, if your wife's not going to listen to you, our wives aren't going to listen to us, and that's not going to go well for anybody. So they talk him into issuing an edict, an actual edict that says that the men are, that all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low. All women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. And I'm all about giving honor to your husbands. Please don't get me wrong on that. But this advice pleased the king, and they also said, and you know what, because your wife didn't do that, you should really just banish her from the land and not let her be the queen anymore. So he said, okay, that all sounds really good. And then in chapter 2, it says, after these things, when the anger of King Xerxes had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. So if you get anything out of today, there's a little PSA here that says, don't make any big decisions about your life when you are merry with wine. So then this brings us to our friend Mordecai. So Mordecai was a Jew in Susa at the citadel, and he was a Benjaminite. So he was a Jewish man, and he was bringing up his niece, whose Jewish name was Hadassah, but she goes by Esther, which means star, and she's the star of our story. Well, Hadassah did not have a mother or father, but he brought her up as her own, and she was described as the young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And really, the beauty that's described about her is a beauty that comes from within. So she was not only beautiful on the outside, but she was really beautiful on the inside. And when we read the story, we see that everywhere Esther goes, she wins favor because of her inner beauty as well as her outer beauty. So what happens is the king's kind of bummed out at his decision, and everybody says, look, it's not that bad. There's plenty more fish in the sea. Let's have a beauty pageant. So now we go into kind of like a bachelor situation where all the young women in the land are invited to enter into this beauty pageant, and they get to go for spa treatments for 12 months, just sitting and soaking and beautifying with cosmetics. And then at the end of the 12 months, there's the rose ceremony, and they each go in to see the king, and he gets to decide which one he has. Well, Esther enters into the ceremony, and right away, with all the people that are kind of there running the whole deal, she wins favor with them. And what I want you to see in this story is, even though God is not mentioned in the story at all, there's all these situations that just so happen. They're circumstantial, coincidental, maybe, but not really, moments where even though God's name isn't mentioned, you can definitely see that he's working all these pieces together for the good of the people in the story and the advancement of the story. So she goes in and she's winning hearts everywhere, and 12 months later, it's her turn to go in and meet the king, and he lays eyes on her and he falls to pieces because she's just the best thing ever, and he falls in love with her, and he makes her queen, and he throws a party because that's what he does. So, you know, at this point, we have kind of a fairy tale going on, you know, beautiful princess or queen gets, brought up an orphan, rags to riches, now she's in the palace and she's queen. And Mordecai, being a very protective father figure, is hanging out at the city gate and just happens to overhear a plot with two of the king's officials that are plotting to kill him. And so what he does is he sends word to Esther, and he reports it to Esther, and Esther makes it known to the king and in the name of Mordecai. And when the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And then it was recorded in this book called the Book of Chronicles in the presence of the king. So the next thing that happens is we're introduced to our villain, our evil, sinister, narcissistic villain. His name is Haman, and he's known as Haman the Agagite. And the Agagites were the descendants of the Amalekites. So if you want to make a note and go back to 2 Samuel 15, if you're into, like, you know, violent Bible stories. There's the Amalekites were, God ordered Saul to wipe him out, and he didn't. And that's when Saul lost his mojo, and eventually David becomes king. But he's kind of a descendant of the Amalekites, and so he has this like really deeply rooted bitterness towards the Jews that has been there not only in him, but in the generations of his family before him. So the king promotes Haman to become his right-hand man. He becomes basically like the prime minister of the land. And he tells all the people, this is Haman, the prime minister. You all need to bow down to him and treat him just like you would treat me. Well, everyone does except for Mordecai. Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, and Haman was filled with fury. And so when the people told Haman, hey, this guy Mordecai that doesn't want to bow down to you, guess what? He's Jewish. It incensed him even more. And he decided that he was going to go talk the king into issuing another edict to annihilate all the Jews. Well, at this point, we see that the king is slightly a bit of a pushover, and he agrees to that. And so to decide the date of this annihilation, Haman literally just rolls the dice. And the word for dice in the Persian language is pur. Everybody say pur. And hang on to that, because what happens is he rolls the dice and he decides that 11 months later, on the 13th of Adar in the Jewish calendar, is the day that they're going to plan to annihilate the Jews. Well, word gets around, and Mordecai finds out, and he just becomes so upset, and he loses his ever-loving mind and starts putting on sackcloths and ashes on his head and starts weeping and fasting. And Esther finds out he's not in a good place, so she sends word to find out what's wrong with him, and he sends word back to her about this whole decree, and he sends a copy of the decree because it was sent out to all the cities, and he had it in his hands, and he gave it to her, and he says, look, Haman is planning to annihilate all the Jews, and you're there for such a time as this. You need to go tell the king. Well, back then, the law was that if you did not get invited to come and speak to the king, even if you were his wife, you could be killed. Like, you couldn't just show up and like share your heart with your husband. That's not how it worked. So she says to him, it's been 30 days since he's talked to me, and if I go in there without an invitation, I could be killed. And he says to her in this very pivotal point in the story in chapter 4, he says, do not think for yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you've even come to this kingdom for such a time as this. So I want to pause there, because what we read here is really important. God's plans will not be thwarted. And he invites us in to this amazing life where we get to be part of what he's doing. And that life is like a life of abundance for us, but it's also a part of a bigger story that he's writing for all of humanity to be reconciled to him. And that plan is never going to be thwarted. So sometimes when he asks us to do something, he gives us the free will to say yes or no. But if we say no, often we're the ones who miss out, because deliverance is going to rise from another place. If not you, it'll be someone else. So we get to decide if we want to participate in that. So what Esther says to him, her response is, okay, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and he did everything that Esther ordered him to do. And there's this sense, this is the only part in the story where we get any sense that there is a perspective shift and a focus towards a higher power. And because they're Jews, we know that it's God and it's our God. So she shifts her perspective and she goes to fast and pray. Now, last week we learned a bit about fasting, and we learned that fasting slows you down, and it helps kind of, sometimes it helps purge things out of you that maybe God doesn't want there, and it gives you space to slow down and to hear and to see from God. Well, fasting often is accompanied with praying in the Bible. And the point of fasting is to fill that time with God's presence and prayer. And so as she's fasting, she's waiting expectantly for her marching orders. But God doesn't give her this big elaborate plan. He doesn't say, well, this is what we're going to do, and this is how it's going to happen, and this is what's going to go down, and you're going to go here, and you're going to say this. He doesn't give her the answer. Instead, what happens is, in verse 5, chapter 1, we see, on the third day of the fast, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters. She gets up, she puts on her big girl dress, and she does the next right thing. Sometimes when we pray, and we fast, and we intercede on behalf of another or a group of other people, God doesn't give us the whole plan. He just tells us what the next right thing is. We move towards asking him for wisdom and for direction, and often it's just the next right thing. So she goes to the court of the palace, and this is the big moment where, like, if she walks in and she's asked to speak to him, she could get slaughtered right there on the spot. But instead, she walks in, and he sees her, and he remembers how much he loves her, and he extends the scepter to her, and she comes freely to him, and she speaks with him. And he says, what is it that you would like, Esther? Whatever it is that you would like, I'll give it to you. So this is her moment. She can out Haman, and she can save the Jews. But there's something in her that tells her, nope, this is not the right time. So she thinks, what makes the king happy? Parties. Hey, king, come and have a party with me. So she throws a party, and she invites Haman, and they come to her party that day. It's a big feast, and he's having such a good time and enjoying his beautiful wife so much. He says, Esther, whatever it is that you want, ask for it, even half my kingdom, and I'll give it to you. And again, she has an opportunity, but something in her says, no, not the right time, not the right place. So she says, well, how about you come to another party tomorrow? I want to throw another party for you tomorrow. And he says, okay. So Haman's really on his high horse because he gets to party with the king and queen. And as he's leaving, it says that he was leaving merry and in high spirits. So he walks by Mordecai, though. He's happy in high spirits, and he walks by the king's gate, and Mordecai is standing there, and he never rises or trembles before him. And because of that, he was filled with rage. So he goes home, and he says that nevertheless, Haman restrained himself, and he went home, and he got his friends to come over, and he starts venting to his friends and his wife, and he's saying, you know what? I'm like the next guy in line with the king. I'm his right-hand man. He loves me. I'm the only person that Esther invited to this party with the king. I've got all these riches. I've got these 10 really great sons, and nothing makes me more mad than that guy Mordecai because he won't bow down to me. And he's so bitter. So his wife, you know, she decides to give him some advice, and she says, well, why don't you make a stake about 50 feet high and go talk to the king in the morning and you know, talk him into having Mordecai hanged on it. And then, you know, go joyfully with the king to the party and have a good time. And Haman says, oh yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I could probably talk him into that. So that very same night, though, he goes to bed at his house, and the king goes to bed at his house. And when the king goes to bed, he asks for those chronicles. Remember the chronicles that Mordecai's name was recorded in when he saved him from the plot of the two guys that wanted to kill him? He asks for those chronicles to be read to him, some bedtime story about how great his kingdom is. And as he's listening to the story of Mordecai saving him, he asks, did anybody do anything for Mordecai when that happened? And the palace official said, no, we didn't do anything. And at that very next morning, when he's thinking about it again, Haman walks in, and he says to Haman, what honor or distinction has been done for the man who I love and admire so much? And he says, what do you think we should do for the man whom the king delights to honor? So Haman's standing there, and he's like, well, who does the king love more than me? Who does he want to honor more than me? And so Haman's thinking to himself, well, it's got to be me. And he says, well, For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and the crown that the king has worn on his head. And let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. So the king says, you know what? That is such a great idea. Go get the robes, go get the horse, go get the crown, and go and dress Mordecai and put him on the horse and parade him through the city and proclaim to everyone, this is the man that the king delights to honor. Imagine what Haman's feeling. So it says that he went home mourning with his head covered. The dude is humiliated to the nth degree, and he goes home and he talks to his wife, and in that moment even his wife is sensing the divine presence of God in all of this. And she, instead of the bad advice she gave him the day before, she gives him this warning, and she says, look, if Mordecai, whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but surely will fall before him. So he goes to the next party with the king and Esther, and Esther decides, this is my moment. This is my silver bullet time. So she looks at the king and she looks at Haman and she says, by the way, I'm Jewish, and Haman has plotted to kill me and annihilate all of my people. And the king, again, probably merry with wine, is enraged. And he, this time, though, he makes a really good decision, and he doesn't act right away, but he steps outside for a breath of fresh air. And as he's stepping outside, Haman's begging Esther for grace and mercy, and he walks back in. The king walks back in, and Haman just happens to trip and fall on the couch where Esther's sitting. This does not look good at all. And so then the king sees this, and he's already mad about the decree, and he sees this and he says, and you're even going to attack my wife right in front of me? And right away he orders him to be hanged on the very stake that he built for Mordecai. That's rough, man. So Esther saves the Jews. The only thing that was a bummer was that in those days, you couldn't reverse an edict. So he couldn't do anything about the edict that was already put out there. But he told Mordecai and Esther that they could come up with a counter edict to protect the people. And so they did that. They came up with a counter edict that said that on the 13th of Adar, that very same day that the Jews were set to be annihilated, they could protect themselves and defend themselves from anybody who's an enemy of the Jew and wanted to destroy them. And they did. And God once again delivered his people. And to this very day, the 13th of Adar is a day that's celebrated throughout the world by many Jews as a day of celebrating when God delivers his people, because throughout history, we know that the Jews, there's been threats to annihilate the Jews throughout history, and so that's the day that they celebrate. And we can look at that, and we can really see that God takes care of his people, and his plans are never thwarted. So I want to drop into chapter 4 again and go back to that place where Esther turns her attention towards the fast. And this is what we call intercession. It's being a go-between and a standing in the gap between a person or people and God. The definition of intercession is the act of intervening on behalf of someone who's in difficulty or trouble, pleading or petitioning for their case. Intercessory prayer is merely the act of praying, interceding to God on behalf of someone other than yourself. So the thing with fasting and praying too, you know, we're not trying to manipulate God when we go and fast and pray. It's not, I mean, sure, we're invited to come to God and to tell him what we want, to ask for what we want, we're asked to bring to him our dreams and our visions and our desire. He loves that. He wants to hear from us. But when we go to pray and intercede, our sole purpose is not to make God do what we want him to do. The purpose is for us to align ourselves with God and what he wants to do. And oftentimes, I think we go to pray and we're looking for answers right away. We live in this really like right away answer society. I mean, we've got Siri, we've got Alexa, we've got, I mean, Google. Like, if you want to know anything, you can find out the answer right away. And like, okay, so today I had to order an electric toothbrush on Amazon. And like, I go on Amazon and I filter right away the one day. I don't even want to wait the 2 days. Like, you can get it pretty much anything you want from Amazon in 2 days. I want it today. And if I can't get that toothbrush today, I'm going to get a different toothbrush because I want a new toothbrush today. This is the world we live in. Or maybe it's just my world. The world of a Persian queen. But the heart of an intercessor is really the heart of one who is seeking the will of God on behalf of another, regardless of the outcome or cost. If I perish, I perish. Regardless of the outcome or cost, you have the will of God in mind and you have the benefit of the other person in mind. And some of us grew up maybe in traditions where we had to go to church and there was a guy there who was the intercessor, the mediator between us and God, or maybe you grew up with like prayer lists that would come to you and intercession to you was just going through a list and praying for people. And the thing is in the Old Testament, the role of a mediator in prayer was prevalent, and we saw that a lot in Abraham, Moses, David, and Samuel. They were the ones who went and prayed to God on behalf of the people. But in the New Testament, we hear all these amazing words from Paul and other writers that say that, no, like we don't need that anymore, that Christ is our intercessor. King Xerxes, some of you may remember King Xerxes from the movie 300, kind of a rough dude. And then some of you might know of him as from the king in the movie One Night with the King. So two very different caricatures, and this guy is somewhere in between. And some commentators will actually say that Esther and the king are like an allegory of how Jesus closes the gap between us and God. So Esther closes the gap between the king and the people by going to him on behalf of the people, and Jesus closes the gap between us and God when he died on the cross and rose again, and giving us this freedom that we sang about earlier today, this freedom to be in his presence, and this confidence that we can go to him whenever we want. So intercession is kind of funny because it's like you're praying on behalf of the other person, and sometimes you don't know what to pray. And like some of us have been in small groups or maybe women's Bible studies where prayer requests became a lot of details that you did not need to hear. But really what it is, it's praying on behalf of another person in the way that the Spirit intercedes with us. So we're invited in intercession into this like really cool, supernatural, co-mingling situation where Jesus is interceding on our behalf, the Bible says, and the Spirit of God comes in and intercedes and gives us words and things to pray for. So I experienced this a little bit in the last couple of weeks because my eyes were kind of open and my ears were attentive to this kind of activity going on in my life. And the first one I wanted to, oh my gosh, am I out of time already? Okay, sorry. So, okay, I'll wrap it up. So, a couple weeks ago, Stephanie Skipper floating in and out of my head all week long. And I couldn't understand why I kept thinking about her, but every time I thought about her, I prayed for her. And it wasn't like, I wasn't getting on my knees with this like, oh, Jesus helps. I was like, not this like long, elaborate prayer, but it was like, God, would you just help Stephanie today? Be with her today. And then she'd float out of my mind and she'd come back in and like, God, would you just give Stephanie some vision for her life today? I know she's looking for something for what's next for her. And just little tiny things all throughout the week. Well, I decided one day I was just going to text her and check in with her and see how she's doing. And so I text her and I'm like, hey, just been thinking about you and praying for you. And she texts me back, and I didn't even know this, but she and Tim were leading worship at a retreat. And they were there and they were going to tell the story of their marriage. And that particular day was a really intense day, and she needed to hear that God was with her in it. And I didn't know any of that. I mean, that wasn't in my head. I wasn't praying for all of that, but the Spirit of God interceded on her behalf with me, and I just prayed for her, and he didn't need to know. God didn't need to know the exact words, and I didn't need to know the details of what I was praying about. Romans 8, 26 to 27 says, in the same way, the Spirit helps us in our weaknesses. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us through wordless groans. And he who searches our hearts knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for God's people in accordance with the will of God. How awesome is that? You don't even need to know what to pray for. But when God puts someone on your mind, especially if you hear it over and over again, that person keeps coming to mind, know that that's the voice of God. That's the Spirit of God prompting you to come alongside him and the work that he's doing in their lives. The book of Esther is like that. That verse in Romans goes on to the thing that, you know, we all know this. A lot of us know this verse, and we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. That's what the book of Esther is a picture of. It's this picture that God uses all the things. A dumb divorce at the beginning, a drunken king, all this violence, a messed up bachelor situation, an orphan girl that rises to become queen. He uses all the things, not just some things, but all the things for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Another thing that happened to me this week was I had a really rough day last week, and there was, some of you know, my mom lives with us, and she's got multiple sclerosis, and so we take care of her, and we were having kind of a rough morning. It started off with my six-year-old Nathan had gum in his hair. So he missed the bus, and I was late taking him to school because you can get gum out of hair with canola oil, just so you know. So another answer I got quickly from Siri. So I got the gum out of his hair, and he gets to school late, and I'm late for my meeting that morning. And then about towards the end of my meeting, I get a phone call from the caregiver saying, you know, she fell, and I need to get her up, and I need help. So I'm like, oh, great. So I'm driving home, I'm worried about my mom, and I'm like praying, like not intercession, but lamentation. Like, God, why are you not delivering me from all of this? And this is so hard. And every time I try to do something, something else happens, and everything gets interrupted, and nothing works out smoothly. Poor me, poor me, poor me. So I get home, and my friend's mom, who lives in the neighborhood, she comes over to help me. And she walks in the door, and she says, you know what I've learned? When stuff like this happens, this is not an interruption to your day. This is your day. And I'm like looking at her like, okay, I'll receive that. So we get my mom up, and she's safe, and everything's okay, and I get in the car, and I'm thinking about what Alita said, and I look down at my phone, and there's this text message from another woman in our church who I've just been starting to get to know. And the text message is this: I've been thinking about you, and this is what I've been praying. When you are driving your kids around, Jesus is riding shotgun with you. When you're helping your mom and you're at her bedside, he's sitting right there with you. When you're at work and you're talking with people at church, he is there with you. He's giving you wisdom, and he's guiding you along the way. And just this like amazing prayer of like how great it is that God's put me here, and he's with me, and he's got a plan, and my family's going to be fine. And like all the lamentations that I had before were being addressed in this little text prayer that she sent me. And I put the phone down, and I was like, okay, I can do this for one more day. I can do the next right thing. I'm going to get in the car. I'm going to go back to work. I have everything I need for this situation right now. It's all good. I'm just going to do the next right thing. I don't have big answers to my prayers of how this whole situation is going to work out, how this season's going to work out, if my kids are going to come out okay from it. If, you know, I don't have any of those answers, but I don't need them, because the answer to my prayer is Jesus himself. It's him being present with me. It's me knowing that he's there. 2 Corinthians says that all the promises of God find their yes and amen in Jesus. And that's why we pray in his name and we say amen. That's what it It's a little paraphrase, but that's basically what it says. But all the promises of God find their yes and amen in Jesus. When we're praying and we're interceding on behalf of other people, we're praying for healing. We're asking for deliverance from hard situations. We're praying for marriages to stay intact. But more than that, we're praying for God's presence to be made known even when he is most hidden from us. And we're praying for people to have the peace that only comes from God when we know that he's there and we know that he sees us and we know that he loves us. I'm going to end with one more story that was really like a transformative story in our lives about intercession and the next right thing. And it started about 5 years ago on Mother's Day. And I, at the church that I was at, oftentimes at the end of the gathering, the staff would come forward, and like if anybody needed prayer, they could come forward and just ask for prayer, and we would pray for people. And this four-year-old little boy comes to me holding the hand of a woman, and he looks at me with these big brown eyes, and he says, "Will you pray for my mommy?" And I look at her, and I'm like, "Are you his mommy?" And she says, "No, I'm his foster mom." And I immediately came unglued. And I was like, "I don't know what to pray for this." But like, I asked God, I'm like, "God, I need you to tell me what to pray. I need something that's going to bring comfort to this little boy." And so I prayed for him. And he went on his way with Sally, his foster mom. And then Nathan comes running out. He's 2 years old with his craft that he made me for Mother's Day. And I look at the craft, and typically I'm like, "Oh, great, another thing for our fridge." But this time I sobbed, because all I could think about was this four-year-old boy who had just made a craft himself. Did he make it for his mom? Did he make it for the foster mom? Was he waiting to see if he was going to be able to give it to his mom the next morning on Mother's Day? What was going through that poor, broken child's head as he was making a craft at church? And that, I mean, Mother's Day has never been the same for me since that weekend. At the same time that that happened, Steve and I were involved with this ministry where we would go to summer camp with foster kids. And it was called Royal Family Kids Camp. And there was a little boy that was at that camp that we just became really close to, and his name was Seth. And Seth would come to our house once a month or once every couple of weeks to hang out with us, and he just became a part of our family. He was the same age that Silas was at the time, and so he just fit right into our family. And we loved that little boy, and every time he would go home, I would just cry because I knew he was going back to this foster home in Compton, and it was not a good situation for him. And then eventually his sister started coming along too. So we had Seth and Lila over a couple times a month. And I became an advocate for them, trying to help them get reconciled with their mom. Well, that summer it became really obvious that it wasn't going to happen, that their mom wasn't doing the right things that she needed to do to get her kids back. So the DCFS worker said to me, "Are you guys interested in taking Seth?" And so we had already begun praying for Seth regularly, and we, as much as we loved Seth and wanted him to be in our home, there was no way we were going to separate him from his siblings. And at that point, you know, Delilah was coming over too, and I was not going to separate him from Delilah, and I wanted Delilah too. And we already had four kids. We had a 1,200 square foot house with one bathroom. I could barely handle what we had. And so the idea, like, surely God, you're not calling us to adopt. But I love these kids, and it breaks my heart to know that they're getting older, and the chances of them getting adopted are becoming fewer and fewer. So she says to me, "Look, if you can't adopt them, maybe you can find someone else who will," because they also had a younger brother. So there's three of them, Seth, Lila, and Joe. So I go to church, and I run into Sally again, the foster mom of the four-year-old. And we had started to develop a friendship, and I think, you know, foster moms stick together. So I asked Sally, "Hey, do you know anybody by chance who's interested in adopting a set of three siblings?" And she says, "Well, we just moved to this area so that we could buy this bigger house because we want to adopt more kids. So we might be interested in adopting three siblings." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And she says, "Well, I'm going to go home and pray about it with my husband and my kids, and I'll let you know." A few days later, she calls me and she says, "We've prayed about it. We're all in. We want the kids." So she begins this relentless pursuit over 2 years of cut all the red tape that you can imagine that there is in the LA County foster care system. And she's pursuing these kids, and she's advocating for them, and she's trying to get visitation with them. And we're not allowed to tell the kids that there's these people wanting to adopt them. And so, because in case it doesn't work out, so we're just praying and praying and praying and keep having them over, and we're building friendship with the Elagians, and they live like 5 minutes from us, so we could, like, even though they're not ours, we could do life with them. Well, then God starts moving us towards coming to Nashville. And we were heartbroken, thinking we cannot leave these kids and be another couple that's abandoned them in their story. Well, don't you know, 1 month before we moved here, Seth, Delilah, and Joe moved in with the Elagians. And now they're adopted, 100% adopted, and they have their forever family with the Elagians. I didn't know when that four-year-old boy came and asked me to pray for his mom, that I was praying for his mom, but also the hand of the woman I was holding. And I didn't know when that boy first started coming to our home that we were going to have a part in his story. You know, it was nothing what I imagined it would be. But through interceding on behalf of these kids, God showed us time and time again what the next right thing is. So your practice for the week: who has God brought to mind for you? Who comes in and out of your head? Who is it in your life that needs prayer? And you don't need to know all of the details, but just pray for them. Maybe if you see someone here today and they're telling you about their life and how rough it's been, what if we prayed for people right then and there and just knocked it off our to-do list in the moment? As awkward as that can be sometimes, like, can I pray for you right now? Like, sometimes for some of us, that's really awkward. But I have never had anybody say, no thanks. It's not a thing. You know? Pray for each other. Let's be a church that prays for one another. You know? And, like, what is God saying to you? Like, what is he telling you that they might need? And should you share it with them? All it takes sometimes is telling somebody, God put you in my head all week, and I've been praying for you, and whatever it is that is going on in your life, just know that he sees you because he told me to pray for you, and that's what I'm doing. How comforting is that when you've heard that from someone else? So as we close, I want you to just take a few minutes and close your eyes. Who is it that God has put on your heart? You can put 2 feet on the floor, close your eyes, open your eyes. You can stand up when the music starts to play if you want to. Whatever posture you want to be in, to just connect with God right now in this time, in this place, because you have been put here for such a time as this. Who is it that God has moved you to pray for? Who comes to mind often? And if there's no one, ask God to give you someone. And ask God, what is it that you want to reveal about yourself to this person? God, what is it that they need? Because we know, God, that you have everything that we need, and you give us everything that we need at the exact moment of our need. And even though our timing isn't always the same as your timing, God, we trust you in your goodness and in your grace and your sovereignty, God, that you have the best timing of anybody. And so in our waiting, in our groaning, in our not knowing what to say or how to pray, Lord, would your spirit just intervene? Would you help us stand in the gap of people who need their arms held up? God, let us be people who truly love and encourage one another in prayer. God, would you make your presence known? Would you help every one of us know that you see us and that you love us, God, and especially for those that carry a weight with them today, Lord, would you just reveal yourselves to them in a fresh way?